Welcome back to Not Like a Regular Mom. Today, I am sitting down with Jessica Rowley, one of the authors to the First Conversations book series. This is a series I just love and appreciate so much as a parent, and I am thrilled to share more about them today, as well as how to tackle some tougher conversations that come up with kids. There are so many things that we should be discussing with our kids from a young age, but we feel kind of skittish or awkward about them. And First Conversations does an incredible job of making these conversations happen naturally and in a way that kids can actually understand. Thank you so much for being here, Jessica. Please share some background about you and your involvement in the series.
Sure, of course. Well, thank you, first of all, so much for having me on. I'm thrilled to be here. So my name is Jessica Rowley. I'm a parent, first and foremost, of two kids who are 9 and 12 now. But when we started working on the First Conversation series, they were 3 and 5. So they were right in that age group that we were writing for. And I work at Brooklyn Public Library. I've been there for 11 years. I'm currently getting my library degree so I can be a real librarian. And part of what I get to do is design early literacy programs for young children and families. And a lot of that is just listening. It's listening, you know, to what parents and caregivers are navigating, what they're thinking about, the kinds of questions they're asking. And at the library, the answer to those questions is often books. So I'm often connecting, you know, parents and caregivers with books when they feel unsure or stuck. What else seems important about me? I guess identity-wise, I'm a white cis woman. I'm in my late 40s. I grew up as an only child of a single mom who ran a daycare out of our home. So early childhood was always, you know, front and center in my childhood and really became a very important part of my career and what I pursued later in life.
That's amazing. I love hearing about your background and how it sort of informed your work. How did the book series get started?
Yes, that's a great question. So I think, you know, there are so many reasons this book series exists, but it truly wouldn't exist without my amazing co-author, Dr. Megan Madison, because years before we started writing these books, I invited Megan to the library to lead workshops for parents and caregivers on how to do this, how to talk with young children about race and racism. Later, she came back. She led workshops that explored consent and gender development in early childhood. So this was work that she had already been doing for years. And it really blew my mind. And it fundamentally changed the way that I was thinking about my own parenting, my own work with families, my own work with educators. And I think what stood out immediately in all of these workshops was how many questions the grownups had. Around race, you know, they noticed that their kids were noticing skin color, noticing difference, but they didn't feel like they had the language, maybe even the permission to talk about it. Some weren't sure why it mattered at all or whether it was even appropriate to bring up with such young children. And then the same with consent and gender. And after these workshops, one of the main things families were looking for was ways they could, you know, take what they had learned, carry it into everyday life, and they wanted books. They wanted books that would help them do that, children's books. And at the time, you know, this was around like 2018, there weren't that many books on these topics. There are so many more now, and I'm so grateful for that. But I think that they were looking for books that to help them do what I think is really the hardest part, and that's having real conversations about such complicated ideas using age-appropriate language, age-appropriate examples, understandable language. All of this is really hard to do with young children about any topic, but especially these kinds of topics. So that gap really stayed with me. And my work, you know, connecting families with books and resources really helped to crystallize the idea for this series.
So incredible. I love how Megan has really impacted how you see all of this. And I think that's what you've kind of done for me as a mom, both of you. I think as a millennial, I grew up in a world where, especially as a white person, it was just like these, like The message is sort of the underlying message is sort of like these issues aren't like things that are appropriate to talk about. Let's just don't ask questions about things like this. Like being quote, like quote unquote, colorblind is sort of how we were, told to go through the world. But we now have such a different understanding of it. And I think, what do you say to people who think that kids are too young to know about these issues or that they're inappropriate topics for kids?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, I usually start by saying that kids are not too young. I think adults are just uncomfortable, and we have lots of reasons for being uncomfortable because we don't have a lot of the, models that we should have had for having these kinds of conversations. As you talked about this idea of colorblindness, I was also raised, I was, I went to a very diverse high school. And elementary and middle school, but the overarching message is we're all the same. Everyone, be kind to everyone and be colorblind. And I think that, I learned later on, I wish I had learned it earlier, that that really shuts down like honest conversations about race and racism. And it also really denies the lived experience of people of color in our country, right? So young children are already noticing differences. They're already noticing patterns. They're noticing unfairness. They're seeing race. They're seeing gender expectations. They're having strong feelings about their bodies, whether we talk about it or not. So the question isn't if they're encountering these ideas, it's who's helping them make sense of them, right? And there's a lot of research showing that kids notice skin color in infancy. They start to assign meaning to those differences in early childhood, and they're already absorbing bias from the world around them because the world is full of bias. And children of color can experience racism as early as toddlerhood. So that being true, it tells me that, white children aren't too young to learn about race and racism, which is what I sometimes hear, when I'm talking about this, especially in a group of, white educators or librarians. So I think it's important also to say that we talk about complex things all the time with young children, right? So we talk about dinosaurs, we talk about space, we teach them math, we talk about weather disasters. We just do it in developmentally appropriate ways, and we know that understanding develops over time. So I think that's what these books are doing, offering simple, concrete, honest language without overwhelming kids or adults.
I totally agree. I feel like the way that our generation was raised, for most of us anyway, it's like if we erase the identity of the people, we're erasing the bigotry and it really creates like a block for kids and often adults to understand the need for equity, just that concept of equity, and it just creates a barrier of understanding. So I really, really appreciate how I think our generation is trying to do something different, and definitely these books are giving us the language that we need.
Yeah, and just one more add-on to that, because that's a really good point. I was just talking to a colleague. We're preparing to talk about a program we run at the library together called Anti-Racist Family Day, where we do a lot of hands-on activities with families to teach them about anti-racist parenting practices. And she was telling me about a training that we did at the library probably in like 2019. She's a person of color. And she said that it was so upsetting for her that the white her white colleagues didn't know how to describe or define racism, and they couldn't come up with any ideas, any examples of racism either. And these are all people, who have been through school, been through grad school, working in one of the most diverse library systems in the world, arguably. And I was at that training, and it was true. And again, it goes back to this sort of responsibility that I think white people have to know about this, even if it doesn't feel as necessary to talk about because or we think it's not impacting us. It can be so traumatic for the people that then we become close to, or we work with, or we want to build relationships with if we are not aware, of their lived experiences.
That is so interesting, and I'm sure a lot of people would face the same struggle trying to describe that, unfortunately. And I think what I've noticed from the books is that, and your website, I have to mention that you have such a brilliant way of talking about things while without shaming adults or children. But like on your website's frequently asked questions page, I wrote this down. I saw a question that said, "What if I'm really uncomfortable having these conversations?" And the response is, "That's so great. Sounds like you're already practicing the important skill of noticing your emotional state. One thing we try to do when we notice we're feeling uncomfortable is to slow down and give that emotion a little space to breathe. Then, once it's not acute, we do a little reflection. Why am I feeling uncomfortable? How does my discomfort relate to my own positionality, my role, my identity, etc.? What am I afraid of? How likely is that to happen? What would I need in order to feel ready to be brave and act in spite of my fears? How can I meet a plan? How can I make a plan to meet those needs?" It's just so beautiful and important, and it's like actual tangible advice. And I think a lot of people who are in positions of privilege, just they get tripped up, and there's a lot of guilt and shame in our truth, and it's just a barrier to connecting.
I have to say that passage is so cool because it reads like a workshop that Megan was leading at the library. And that was one of the goals for these books was I thought in my head, like, how can I this work has been so impactful for me in my parenting and, in my work with families. Like, how can I get everybody in the room with Megan? And the answer was through these books and through providing that back matter that really helps, I think, parents and caregivers, all adults. It's helped my mom, as a grandparent, get to a place where we feel more comfortable and more informed having these kinds of conversations.
Why are these conversations so hard for some adults to have with children, especially for with our own kids?
That is a great question, and I empathize with it because it is incredibly hard, especially with your own kids. And I think it goes back to a lot of our own experience as kids when we were growing up. These topics were either avoided or they were dealt with in really vague ways, so that when kids ask us real specific questions, we don't have the language or the models to fall back on. And I think that feels really paralyzing. And then there's a lot wrapped up in it emotionally, talking about race, gender, consent. I know for me, it brings up my own childhood. It brings up, many mistakes that were made or things that I heard that confused me or made me upset. We have fears about getting it wrong. And I think parents are often trying, we're trying to protect our kids' innocence and at the same time protect ourselves from discomfort. And then I've talked about how for white parents in particular, there's that added layer of privilege. So just the ability to postpone these conversations is a privilege. But kids do not stop noticing just because we are not talking about it. And I think when adults shut things down or delay, children are still making meaning, but they're doing it on their own, or they're doing it later with their peers, and they're using the messages that society is giving them, which includes a lot of bias. So the one thing I would really want parents to hear, and what helped me a lot, is you don't need to do this perfectly. You just need to stay in relationship with your children around these topics. And these books are meant to support adults as much as kids, give you language, give you structure, give you permission to start. But it's, we call it first conversations for a reason. It's not a one and done thing. It's really building a foundation, and it's gonna grow as you grow. It's gonna grow as your child grows, but staying in that relationship where you can have these kinds of open conversations is so important.
I totally agree. And I think that they're getting so many messages, whether we want them to or not, from society, from peers, from media, that the information is in their brains. So they either are going to get a version of it that's maybe not great, or maybe not what we want, the values that we want them to grow up with, or they're going to have the conversation with us. So I think that's a really good point. And sometimes My kids will come home from school and say that their friend said something that, something about what we talked about at home and how what we talked about is wrong. Like, how do we handle those conversations when other kids that come from less tolerant or misinformed households say things like that? And how do you feel like these books and the messages hold up against the incessant cultural messages kids receive from their peers, from media, from other adults?
Yeah, those cultural messages are loud. And I think kids are absolutely swimming in them from a very early age, from toys, from television, from advertising, and then school, from, of course, family members, maybe, peers, starting from an early age. And now that I have tweens, it just kind of gets louder and louder. And I don't think that one book or one series can compete with that all on its own. It's not meant to. But I think what these books do offer is a counter narrative and, most importantly, language. Language to, notice, language to question, language to push back on these ideas. And it becomes a tool. Right? All of that becomes a tool to use throughout life to think critically about the messages we're receiving. I think when kids are young, you might feel like you're doing a lot of that scaffolding for them and pointing things out and initiating the conversations. But as kids get older, they're going to start to be able to use those tools independently. I think that's really the goal. I notice this a lot with my kids when we watch older movies or shows. From about, 5 or 6, they were able to start naming racism, misogyny, transphobia, and they're even able now to put it into a context of today, like what has changed and what's still happening, what's still unfair, what patterns do we still notice? And I think, when a kid has words for what they're seeing, like fairness, unfairness, stereotypes, consent, in our book about race, we have this big page where it says that's not right. I've heard kids say that so many times in story time. I've heard my own kids say it and apply it to so many other things. So they have that language now. They're not just passively absorbing those messages anymore. They're engaging with them, and they're thinking critically. So, yeah, I really think these books can be anchors. They don't replace everything that kids are exposed to. There's no way to do that, but they give families a shared language and a set of values you can return to again and again and again as your kids grow and as the world, seems to be getting more complicated.
I love that. That makes so much sense that it's just a tool for them. And I really believe that. My son, he's going to be 9 in a couple months, and he and I have had conversations for years, ongoing conversations about so many social issues, and he's had these books for years. And the other day he told me that someone in his class said something about their gender, that maybe they're not the gender that they have thought that they were up until now, and he didn't know. It was an interesting conversation to have with my son because he didn't know. He's like, maybe they were joking, I don't know. And I was like, it's important to just listen and take it seriously. And he's like, but I kind of laughed. And I was like, well, why did you laugh? And he was like, because sometimes when things that we talk about at home, like the things that you tell me happen in real life, I just can't believe that they're happening. And it's just so interesting. Like I was glad to have like kind of set the groundwork. But kids are still going to be kids. They're going to have their own reactions. And I was so glad that we were able to like have that conversation. And I was like, it's okay, like laughing sometimes if you're nervous or you're unsure, it happens, but just make sure you support your friend and just think about all of these conversations I didn't have growing up and how different that situation could have become.
Yeah, definitely. And I think younger children might say things like that more often, or might laugh, or might do things at inopportune times. And I think it can be, I feel like a lot of adults panic in those situations if you haven't had some of those foundational conversations that you're talking about. And I think the first thing I would say in that moment is just pause and breathe. A lot of times when kids say these kinds of things or do that, they're not trying to be cruel. They're experimenting with language, they're testing ideas, they're maybe repeating things they're absorbing. They're trying to make sense of a difference. So I think, those are all really great opportunities to continue the conversation, to continue to build that foundation.
Yeah, it was not. I had that feeling in the pit of my stomach, like, oh, I hope his laugh didn't come off like he was laughing at his friend. You're beating yourself up, but just knowing that we can have this ongoing conversation and reminding him you can be there for your friend and tell them that you heard what they said and you can have these conversations. It's okay. Just kind of normalize it, just like anything else. If their friend were to tell them anything else, and that's a really good point, what you mentioned about our reaction as parents, because I know that kids can sometimes say things that horrify us, like they don't like the color of their friend's skin or something like that. And like, how do we talk about these things without inducing shame in our kids for saying something hurtful or inappropriate when they're just trying to figure it out without the context that we have?
We do have some great tools for this in the back matter of our skin. And all of our back matter, I should say, is available for free, even if you don't have the books, on firstconversations.com. So, if this happens to you, I would go check out those resources. But I will say, first, it depends on the situation, but I think, if something like this was said to a peer, I always like to make sure that my kids know to make sure their friend is okay. Like, we need to make sure that your friend is okay because something was said to you that your friend that was harmful. Make sure there's support from a trusted grown-up in that situation, because those comments do cause harm if they are heard. Even if that hurt was unintentional. So that's something we talk about. Even if it's after the fact and we can't do anything about it, I like to talk to my kids about, like, well, let's make sure that friend is okay because this could have hurt their feelings. At the same time, we have to be careful about how we do that because we know that shame shuts learning down. So if there is shock or anger in our voices, if we, respond with something just like blanket, like we don't say that. Kids learn, I think, very quickly, this is a dangerous topic, right? And then they stop bringing their questions to us. And I've definitely messed up like this, and I've noticed that pattern where, okay, I responded because I got so shocked that my kid would say something like that, and now I notice like they're careful about what they're going to tell me for a little while, and I have to rebuild that trust. So I like to talk in those moments with my kids about impact and intent, right? So with this particular example you gave, you might say, skin color isn't something that's bad or good. It's just different. And everybody deserves to feel proud of their skin. Or if you want to be more specific about feelings, that's a comment that could hurt someone's feelings. So let's talk about what you're noticing and what you mean without saying something that could hurt our friend, and just sort of shift that language. You're giving them a moment to learn new language. You're helping them build a more accurate, more humane understanding of the world by understanding impact versus intent. And hopefully, you're removing shame from an instance where they may not have had all the facts, and that's why they said what they said. This makes me think of my oldest when they were about 9, noticed that some white grown-ups get really angry when we talk about racism. It was something that they saw on television, in the news. And I asked them, why they think that is. Why do people get angry if we just want to talk about racism and, with kids specifically? And Jack said, they probably didn't learn about it when they were young like me, so they're mad or they feel bad. And I thought that was really true. I thought, the shame of not understanding something gets in the way of learning and accepting new ideas sometimes. So if we as parents just keep focusing on removing shame, even when we're correcting our kids and giving them new information, I think that opens the door to so much more understanding. And then hopefully when they're grown up, they don't get so angry about things that they just simply don't understand yet.
Yeah, that's really great. And I think that's, you know, with the situation with my son and his classmate and how, you know, I was like, you know, laughing is not ideal. You want to make sure your friend's okay, but let's focus on moving forward. Like we need to, I'm big on like teaching my kids repair because they're not always going to get it right. We don't always get it right. And just teaching him that you can do better going forward and making sure like, you know, you just had an uncomfortable reaction, but make sure, yeah, like other people know your values, your character. And I think that these things can be taught from such a young age. And like you said, yeah, hopefully they won't grow up into an adult that has that type of reaction.
Oh, just yeah, one thing about repair, because I love that. And I mean, that's a word I don't think I ever heard growing up from my, from the grown-ups in my life. But I think one thing that really does build trust and remove shame from a lot of this is I found apologizing to your kids after you get something wrong or you responded in a way that was angry. I apologize, if there's something where I react and then later I think like, oh, that wasn't really how I wanted to say it, I'll simply apologize and I'll, try again, or I'll ask them like, do you mind if I try that again? I want to explain it in a different way that doesn't hurt your feelings or make you feel like you did something wrong. Nothing builds trust like apologizing and then repairing.
Exactly. I love that. I think it's really, really important. And I think that's probably a lot of people in our generation probably did not have that. So I think that's something that we're doing right, hopefully, as parents. So I have a 4-year-old son, and I have noticed that I think that kids that age seem to learn in part by putting things into categories. So it's taken him a really long time to understand the concept of gender expanding beyond like boys and girls. And he sometimes will still insist like a person or a character is either a boy or a girl. And I find myself like not wanting to push my, you know, my values and ideas onto him, but also wanting to teach him the right things and correct him and not shame him. So how can we answer these questions and let kids know more about things like asking about pronouns before assuming when they're at the age where their brain is just sort of starting to kind of come online and understand those things?
Yeah, I think first of all, it's so developmentally on point for a 4-year-old to do that. So I think it's really important to start there. Young children at that age are really relying on categories to make sense of the world. That's how their brains work. That's how they're building connections in their brain. So when a child insists that's a boy or that's a girl, it's not stubbornness or closed-mindedness. It's really them trying to organize information into categories. So what I like to encourage parents to do is something I call expand the category. So you might say something like, a lot of people are boys or girls, some people are neither, some are both. And we repeat I repeated that so many times with my kids when because this came up over and over. There were a lot of questions. Is that a boy or is that a girl? No, that's a boy. That's definitely a boy. And so it kind of became a mantra that a lot of people are boys or girls. Some people are neither. Some people are both. Or I switched it out sometimes with, we can't always know someone's gender just by looking at them. So I think these are ways to honor that they need categories, right? So we're giving them categories, we're just expanding them into neither and both. And we're introducing gender diversity by doing that. And then I think you can keep it practical. You can model that curiosity instead of going into correction and say something like, I'm not sure actually if that's a boy or a girl. We could ask them what pronouns they use. Or let's wait and see how they describe themselves. If it's another child, they might not be using preferred pronouns at that point. But if they're talking about an adult, that's something that I've taught my kids. Just wait and see how they introduce themselves or describe themselves. And I think, again, repetition is key. Kids don't need to understand the gender binary all at once. This is a practice and not a lesson that you deliver one time and move on from. And it's also, it might look messy along the way, but every time I think you model not assuming gender, even casually, you're teaching something really, really powerful.
I love that. Yeah, it definitely can be messy along the way. I was going to also ask you how to handle, like, my little one got really excited, is the best way I could put it, when he saw someone. We were at a store and he said, "Oh, mommy, that's one of those people who looks like a boy but who has girl hair." And I just sort of froze. You find yourself freezing, even when you know, like, you've practiced these conversations in your head. So, what do you think is the best way to handle a situation when a kid, like, loudly calls out, like, "Oh, that person's in a wheelchair," or that person, they call out what they're seeing?
Yeah, we've all been there, I think. And again, kids aren't being malicious, especially young children. They're being observant. So the goal is not to silence them. We want them to be observant. We want them to be curious. So it's more about teaching context and care. In our book, Our Skin, we suggest, I think this is in the back matter, we affirm their curiosity with something like, "I love how curious you are. I love how much you notice," right? And then we pivot and we say, "Let's talk about this more when we get home, get to the car, get around the corner, in case that person doesn't want us talking about them. It might make them uncomfortable," right? So that's context. So we're telling them that we love how curious they are, but we're going to talk about it when that person can't hear us because it might make them uncomfortable. So that's care. And then I think this is really key. You do have to actually follow up later, right? So it's a lot of times we're busy and like we have so much going on with kids and 10 million things happen between the time they've done that and there's a moment to talk about it. But I do think it's really important to revisit it. And then in that moment, I think it's a lot about your energy too, how you handle it. If you're calm, if you're respectful, they learn that that curiosity is okay, but that there are thoughtful ways to talk about differences that consider the other person. If we completely shut down what they say and we never revisit it, it does send the message to young children. They're very concrete. So it sends the message that there might be something wrong with that person because our parent got so uncomfortable when we pointed that person out. So they're very literal. They're very, they're making those very concrete associations. So talking about it later and putting it into a better context is really necessary.
That is so helpful. I really love that advice. That's really great. And speaking of freezing, I think a lot of parents also freeze when their kids ask them things directly, whether they're in public or at home, like, "Where do babies come from?" And you're in the car. And what is the best course of action when you don't feel prepared in the moment, but you don't want to ignore their question? Is it sort of the same thing where you just kind of give an answer in the moment and then revisit it later?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite strategies. Freezing is definitely normal. It happens to all of us. One of my favorite tools is simply saying, "That is such a great question." That alone buys you time and it also communicates respect. It's telling them that that was a fabulous question. We love, again, how curious you are. You can follow it up right there with, I need to think about ways to explain that in a way that makes sense. This is something we can talk about more later. For older kids, you can be like, "Remind me if I forget." You're not shutting the question down, you're postponing it with intention. And honestly, you don't. If you do have an idea of what to say, you don't need to give a full, perfect answer. And it doesn't have to be the last time you talk about it again. These things are going to come up over and over again. So I just really want, parents and caregivers to know that in these moments, the awkward ones, the really surprising ones, or the ones that make your stomach drop, these are actually really great opportunities, not to be perfect, but to build trust. So, if kids learn they can bring their hardest questions to you and you will respect them by, finding out the answer and talking about it more, you've already done something really, really powerful and they're going to come to you again and again and again, which is what you want.
That's so great. And I think a lot of parents, they just want to do a really good job. And I think that sometimes we feel ill-equipped to answer things, and, like, we just, like you said earlier, like, we want to do it perfectly. And I also really appreciate, I want to call out in the back of at least most of the books, if not all of them, there's a continue the conversation section that covers like every part, every topic that comes up explicitly or implicitly in the book. And they kind of give like parents a cheat sheet of background to talk with their kids about, like, whether it's I'm looking at the Everybody book. So there's body basics, self-care and community care, body diversity. There's so many things like critical media literacy. Like, you're covering so many topics. I think that's so helpful for parents to have sort of a cheat sheet to look at and say, okay, this is where I can start to have this conversation.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that idea of creating the back matter grew out of our understanding that this would be new for a lot of the grown-ups who, you know, the people, our readers are people who want to do this work. And some know more than we do, and others are coming to it not knowing as much. And so we wanted everybody to kind of be starting from the same place and having access to the same knowledge, you know, and then through the website and through the First Conversations Instagram run by my co-author, we are constantly updating that information as you know, as the world changes and as more information is needed.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. And if you have the book, you can see that it's written, that the text is kind of small. And so my kids, when they get to that page, are like, okay, this isn't for me. Like, it's like parents, it's like the parent zone, perfect for, you know, the end of the book. So I just really appreciate that. And I love to know that, like, you're constantly updating your website, your Instagram. I find your website to be so helpful. I really appreciated, like, the frequently asked questions section. So these are really great resources that I really encourage parents to check out for sure. So sort of pivoting a little bit, I know some kids want to express themselves in ways that sort of challenge gender norms, but they're afraid of bullying. And then parents are put in this position where they're like, I want my kid to express themselves, but I don't want them to be bullied. So how can we encourage our kids to wear what they want, express themselves how they want, while protecting them from the opinions and potential poor treatment from others?
Yeah, this is such a tender place, I think, for parents, because you're holding two real truths at the same time. You want your child to be free and you want them to be safe. And I don't think that there's one perfect answer, but I do think the foundation really matters. For us in our family, that foundation was leading with affirmation and not fear. So my oldest is non-binary. They're 12 now. They started wearing big earrings and headbands in the third grade. And from the very beginning, the message at home was, you look chic, you look amazing, this is a valid way to express who you are. We went earring shopping together. We talked a lot about personal style. I love clothing. I love expressing myself through clothes too. So we talked a lot about how good it can feel to be in touch with what you like and how you want to show up in the world. And then I also let their teachers know what was going on. I asked them to tell me if they noticed any bullying, but that was part of the protection piece. And I didn't share that part with my kid at the time. I was very intentional about not leading with, you might get bullied out there, because I didn't want fear to be the frame. I wanted confidence to be the foundation with which they went out into that world. And then when I later found out that some kids were teasing them at home, we did some role play together. We did this pretty consistently. We practiced what they might say, how they might walk away, when to get help, who was a safe grown-up, because not every grown-up at their school was a safe grown-up to go to, so who could they go to? But all of this was built on the understanding and the foundation that their choices were valid and beautiful, just as valid as their sister, you know, wanting to wear baggy sweatpants and oversized men's t-shirts. What they were choosing was valid and beautiful. I think honesty matters too. You don't want the real world to be a total shock. So you can, if it's necessary, if it feels like the time, you can say, you know, you should get to wear what feels right to you. And sometimes other people aren't going to understand that yet. You can ask your child too, what kind of support they want. You can help them think through where they feel safest experimenting. Is it at home only? Is it with certain friends? Is it at school with trusted adults? Do you need to find explicitly queer kid spaces? We did definitely needed to find explicitly queer kid spaces when my kid was in third and fourth grade because there just weren't as many kids in their class that at least were I, you know, openly identifying as queer. So we sought out camps and after school activities and things that were explicitly queer. And I really think it's important that this shouldn't all be on the child. Yes, they're the expert in their own identity, but they're also still growing and learning. And I think part of protecting kids is advocating for them. So it is your job to talk to teachers. It is your job to talk to caregivers, babysitters, schools, family members, so that your child isn't carrying the full weight of other people's discomfort, of other people's, inability to get their pronouns right. Like that is not up to them to continue to work on. And I still help my tween kiddo manage that kind of stuff because I think kids deserve to know that their grown-ups are in their corner, and when they know that and that they're okay at home, I think it gives them so much more strength to move through the world, even when the world isn't necessarily going to always be kind.
That was such a wonderful answer. I feel like you really tackled so many angles of this with real tangible advice. And just that was, I think the way you have navigated all of that is just beautiful. And I just am so blown away. I think that that is so helpful to all parents, no matter what our kids are going through or the things that they're struggling with or just how they want to express themselves. I think that's just so amazing. That's just such a beautiful way to handle things like this.
Thank you. It was a learning process. I mean, and it continues to be. Because also gender is a spectrum, and so, it can change. Their feelings about their own identity can change. So I think just really moving with them and going back to that trust and that relationship, it's all connected. So the trust that you're building because you answer their questions about other things, that ties back into, I think, the relationship that you'll have with them around their own identity as well.
Absolutely. That was just so great. I honestly am a little speechless. I think you just really nailed that. So I want to talk a little bit about consent and teaching kids consent. And it's a topic that I taught my kids. I have two boys, and basically from birth, I have taught them about consent in ways that I can. So why is it so important for parents to teach their kids from a young age, and what are some age-appropriate ways or situations to bring it up? Because a lot of people hear consent and they're just like, you can't talk about that from now. That's about sex, but it's about so much more.
Yeah, I mean, I love this question because, you're talking about ways or situations, right? It's plural, because it's not a single talk, which is, I think, what we were sort of maybe taught as, when we were teens or a little older, that it's this like one talk about consent. I see it and have learned to see it as more of a relationship, that you build over time. And from birth, kids are learning about consent, whether we name it that or not. Every diaper change, every hug, every car seat buckle, bedtime routine teaches them something about what happens to their body, whether their own signals matter, whether we're listening. And teaching consent early helps kids understand things we really want them to know, like their body belongs to them, right? Who would argue with that? Boundaries matter. Their body boundaries matter, right? We want to grow humans that understand that, and that other people's body boundaries matter too, right? So that's what we're teaching, when we talk about consent with young children. That's it. So if parents remember, I think there are three main things, that I kind of lived by when this was coming up in our house all the time. First, offer choice whenever you can. This is a great way to model. Kids don't always get to choose everything, and we have some scenes in the book that acknowledge that. tension, right? But they can often choose how they do something. So sitting or standing to brush their teeth, a wave, a high five, or a hug to greet someone. Those are small choices you can build into the day that offer a real sense of bodily autonomy, and just model that, every single day. And then giving children clear, shame-free language. So this involves teaching the correct names for body parts. We need to know all the names of body parts. There's a lot of research that shows that kids that know the anatomically correct names of their body parts are less susceptible to child sexual abuse, right? Because they can talk about what's happening to them very specifically. And that's one of many reasons that it protects them. Talk matter-of-factly about bodies without shame, and naming feelings, just talking about feelings all the time. Lots of different names for feelings. You can do this through so many things, through books, through songs, ways that are fun and developmentally appropriate. Because when kids have language, they are safer, they're more confident, and they're more able to ask for help. They're more able to say no. They're more able to describe how they're feeling if something happens. And then I would say, lastly, practice consent yourself in everyday moments. So ask before giving a hug. Notice and point out when a yes turns into a no during play. This is something that comes up a lot during siblings. Like, 1 minute they're wrestling, they're having a great time. Somebody says no, the other person didn't notice. You can point that out and get them into the habit of noticing that themselves, helping them stop right away when somebody says stop. Again, with siblings, I grew up an only child, so this was all new to me, watching in horror as my, child would say stop a million times and their sibling would not stop. And I'm like, what is going on here? You're supposed to stop. But, we practice noticing that together. And now it's like such a big rule in our house, and it's one that they now manage. I don't have to do anything anymore. And then talking about preferences is really important. What is yummy for one person might be yucky for another. That just gets them, again, more in touch with what feels good and what they like. And if they know what they like, they know what they don't like. So yeah, I think it's coming up constantly. There's so many opportunities: tickling, roughhousing, play, personal space. And naming it doesn't make it complicated. It doesn't make it inappropriate. It just makes it very clear. So I think those everyday moments are what you can focus on for that foundation.
That's really great. I really love how you answered that. I think it's so complicated too, because there are so many moments, as you mentioned, that to practice consent on with ourselves. One of my kids decided one day that he didn't like kisses on the cheek, and it was something that I always did with him. And so I would slip here and there and kiss him on the cheek, and I would like always catch myself and say, I am so sorry. I know that you told me you don't like that, and I did it. And I tried to, again, repair and apologize. And he would be like, that's okay, that's okay. And it's like, no, it's not okay. And so it's a moment that you can easily kind of dismiss or just say, oops, sorry. But it's really important to call these things out, because it doesn't complicate things. I think it just kind of gives kids sort of a better idea of why and how to navigate all of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when one of our kids, because it's probably inevitable in these little scenarios, like I like the example you gave with, roughhousing, and someone decides, nope, I don't want to do this anymore, how can we avoid shaming our kids when explaining to them that they violated consent?
Yeah, I think shame comes into these conversations a lot. I think it's something that children kind of feel when they've overstepped a boundary, and they kind of already understand that. So this is where I come back to this parenting idea that I learned from an amazing early childhood educator named Nikolai Pizarro of Raising Readers. And she talks about connection over correction. And that just stayed in my head. It's something that comes up almost every day. It's like, am I gonna correct my child who's eating with their fork in the weirdest way I've ever seen, or am I just gonna like enjoy that we're eating together? And so connection over correction is something I come back to a lot. Because shame does shut learning down if kids feel embarrassed, if they feel scared, if they feel bad about themselves, they're le less likely to come to us again. They're also less likely to reflect on what happened because it feels bad to reflect on what happened if they feel shame about it. So I think instead of focusing on like who they are in that moment, someone who did something terrible, we can just focus on like what happened. And an example, is rather than like that we shouldn't have done that, that was bad, you should know better. We can say things like very specific. Their body said no, so that means we stop. It's very instructional. You can say something like, it looks like you missed their signal, so let's practice noticing it. We did a lot of role play with my daughter while we were writing this book, Consent, so much role play that she actually wrote a song when she was about 4 years old, called Yes No. But yeah, we did a lot of role play where we focused on noticing those signals, and then also give them an opportunity to be better next time, right? So just say, you know what, you missed the signal this time. Let's try again next time. So, often when we say something, when kids have done something we don't like, it makes them feel like they're terrible and it'll never get better. So you always want to give them the opportunity to turn it around, I think.
Yeah, that's really great. One of my questions I was going to ask you is how can we teach the importance of consent to neurodivergent kids who struggle with impulse control? But I think this sort of applies to all kids, what you're saying. And I love the connection over correction. It reminds me of something that, like a little quote that I have written down, says, "Focus on being emotionally available more than trying to control their emotions." And that's something that's really helped me in my parenting and how to handle situations like this. And just calling out the good behavior and really making a point to say that I really like how you listened to your brother when he said he wanted to stop. I think that's been really helpful.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I do love sort of breaking down this idea for neurodivergent kids too, though, because I think impulse control and following consent are not the same thing. And so kids shouldn't be punished for the difference. And I think sometimes it's misunderstood because impulse control is more of a brain-based skill, and then consent is more of a relationship skill, and they're developing on different timelines, I think, for many neurodivergent kids. So, kids with ADHD, sensory differences, their bodies can often move faster than their regulation skills. So even though a child might cognitively understand that no means no, they still might struggle to stop in the moment when they're excited or overwhelmed. And so I think consent needs to be taught really proactively with neurodivergent kids, not just in the moments of conflict. I mean, that doesn't really work for a lot of kids, like you said. The moment of conflict is sometimes a little too heated, but I think building language and skills when everyone is calm, is really important. And this is personal for me too, because my daughter, like I said, she loves this book about consent, and she was really the age when we were writing it that I was thinking about. And she is neurodivergent. She was diagnosed last year with Tourette syndrome, although we knew long before that she was neurodivergent. And when she was younger, we spent a lot of time supporting her around boundaries and big feelings, and especially feelings of rejection and difficulty reading social cues in play. And I think what helped most with her was like using visuals, repetition, role play, concrete language, focusing on what to do, not just what not to do. So we practiced a lot of phrases, and she really clung to those, like, can I hug you? And something she still says. Or do you want to keep playing? Because sometimes she had trouble with reading social cues, so she would ask her sibling many times, do you want to keep playing? Do you want to keep playing? And hearing that yes was really important. And then also the opposite of that, like, I need space. We taught her that, because otherwise it would have, gone a little past the point that she could handle. So she kind of learned to listen to herself and realize when she needed to stop. And giving her that language allowed her to turn that really into like a skill.
Wow, that is really interesting. One of my kids is also neurodivergent, and that's why I brought that up. And I did not comment on how many times you've mentioned role playing, because it is so helpful. I find the same thing with both of my kids, but particularly, yeah, with neurodivergent kids. I think it's such an underrated tool for parents. So thank you for mentioning that, because it really is so great. I guess the one thing that I struggle with consent in particular, is my neurodivergent child. I really like what you said about how it's more developmental than anything, but yeah, it's really hard for my other child to understand that the rules seem slightly unfair or different for them.
Yeah, that's definitely a I think a dynamic that happens in a lot of sibling relationships where one sibling is neurodivergent. So that I think is a larger conversation just about that imbalance and that dynamic because it will show up in so many different ways. And one way that we talk about it is, you know, that and this also made it into our last book in the series, which is all about disability and disability justice, is that, you know, fairness means that everybody gets what they need. It doesn't mean that everybody gets the same thing. And I think, you know, giving some concrete examples, I think, you know, when we talk about that in the book about disability, there's a story time that's happening outside. And the kids are all sitting using different kinds of seating. Some kids are laying down. Some kids have a snack, like things that, you know, having worked in a preschool, I know that there would, had there not been a foundation to kind of explain why this is happening, kids would be like, that's not fair. They get to sit on, you know, a stool and I have to sit on the grass, or they get to hold a device and, you know, I don't get to hold a device. It's a communication device. They get a fidget and I don't get a fidget. So it's definitely it's not just something that kids will naturally understand. I feel like it's something that we have to talk about as what is fair looks different for everybody. And everybody has needs, right? So it's not just the sibling who's neurodivergent who has needs. You have needs too. So let's talk about what your needs are as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. Again, back to how it's called First Conversations. The books are called First Conversations, that it's just one of many conversations about these things. It's a really good reminder.
Definitely.
So I don't want to keep you, I could talk to you for hours, but I don't want to keep you too long. And I wanted to sort of wrap up and ask you where people can find your books and if there are any new ones coming out.
So all of the First Conversations books are available pretty much wherever you buy books, local bookstores, libraries, online, even if they don't have the books in your local bookstore. You can request that they order them, and that's pretty easy for them to do. So we love it when people buy from their local bookstore, if that's possible. And the series includes 8 books. There are no more books in this series, but they are continuing to be translated into different languages. All of them are going to be translated into Spanish, and then some have been translated into Korean and Greek, and it's been very exciting to see that happen. And there's a box set coming out next year, of the first 3 books, I believe, and then they'll box the rest of them as well. So, and then I talked a little bit in the beginning, there's an audiobook collection. And I think the audiobooks can be really helpful for people who have really never talked about some of these topics. It's like maybe have the audiobook do a little bit of the work for you in the beginning, but then make sure you also read it together with your kids too.
Yeah, the audiobooks, that is so cool. Even if you're just in the car and you want to throw something on, or you're doing a puzzle. I put on like a kid's podcast with my son the other day when we were doing a puzzle. It's like they'll listen, they'll pick up on things. That's a really good tip for people who feel uncomfortable getting that first read. So where can people follow you or First Conversations on social media and find additional resources for the topics that you cover? Because we talked about your website and all of that.
Yeah, so I think two places are really the best for the books. If you go to firstconversations.com, we have additional resources. We have all the back matter, so all that stuff that we wrote for the grown-ups for each book is available for free on the website. And then for more up-to-date information, at first_conversations on Instagram. This is an amazing resource run by my incredible co-author, Dr. Megan Madison, who shares up-to-date resources, advocacy tips, reading lists, conversation tips, really great ways to keep these discussions going and make connections to all the things that are happening in our world. So those are really the two best places.
Awesome. And can you share your best piece of parenting advice?
Yes, I thought about this a little bit, and I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about what's happening right now in our country with ICE, and in Minnesota. And so I think it's really important that we talk with our kids about this, about ICE, even if they're very young. Everything we just talked about is connected to what we see happening, in our country right now. Understanding injustice, consent, children's rights as humans. And I think this falls into the same category like race, like gender. You know, topics like this parents feel like are too big or too scary, but really children are picking up pieces of this from school, from the media, from conversations that they overhear. So just like everything we've been talking about, I don't think silence protects them. I think giving them context really protects them. And just like with our books, you don't have to say everything all at once. You can start with, I think, things that are developmentally appropriate to talk about. You can focus on fairness, on safety, what your family values are, that, you know, we care for families, we care about children, we care about our neighbors. You know, you can talk about how some systems don't treat people equally. You can, you know, use some of our books to ground those conversations. I think it's really important to reassure kids about who keeps them safe in their own lives, because they might be hearing things that are scary and they might actually wonder if they're safe. And then I think you can invite their questions. This is the kind of topic where I'm always surprised at what my kids already know. And so the question I like to ask them to get them started is like, tell me what you've already heard or what you already know. And with younger children, maybe that's not a question that's going to work. So I think you might have to guide that conversation. And I'm happy to give you some resources if you have show notes, because there are a lot of amazing educators that have been creating great resources for this conversation. So I'm happy to share those with you for your show notes.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for mentioning that. I really, really appreciate that you brought that up. And please absolutely share those resources. I will put them in the show notes. It's really helpful for parents. I think a lot of us are struggling with it. Do we talk about this? How do we talk about this? So that would be amazing.
Yeah, no problem. I think, you know, it's so important to share that what we're seeing is scary, but it's also not new. So to put it into some kind of context, I think understanding history really helps kids and adults see patterns instead of as isolated events. So there's a lot of resources that can put this into some historical context that I think, you know, both kids and adults can benefit from understanding. So I'm happy to share those resources with you.
You are so wonderful, Jessica. This has been such a joy to talk to you and to learn from you. I feel like I've learned so much in the last hour. I'm so excited to put this episode out and for more parents to learn about your books and pick up your books. So thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure, and I hope that it's helpful. And yeah, if people want to reach out through social media or through our website, we'd love to hear how you're using these books in your community as well.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.